Thank you. I apologize for my voice. Mark, can you hear me? Fine, you can turn it up. So my talk really belongs to the previous session or to Friday's afternoon session, not to the numerical session. I'm going to discuss three topics. One of them is interaction between inflows and outflows in high redshift galaxies, evolution of disk giant clumps that we've seen in Elliot's talk this morning, and third about compactification and quenching, the terms blue nuggets and red nuggets. So inflow and outflow, this is a movie that Romain did with Ramses. Galaxies, massive galaxies at high redshift, are fed by streams along the cosmic red filaments. And indeed, a typical galaxy is fed by three major narrow cold streams. The point that's relevant to outflows is that the inflows that you see here on the sky between 1 and 2 RVR is limited to very narrow filaments, which tend to be in planes. That's a different story. But most of the solid angle is empty for the outflows to go out. So there's a lot of room for the outflows to go out. Now, the big question is how these inflows get into the disk eventually. There are the streams at the VL scale, there's the disk, and there's a messy region here of interface of a radius of 20 kiloparsec or so, in which God knows what happens. Everything breaks loose. There's a breakup due to shocks and hydro and thermal instabilities, collisions of streams, clumps, and maybe some heating going on. And the big question is, how do the streams eventually join the disk? So here's my toy model for how the streams, actually the angular momentum is getting to the disk. There's work that's being published now and similar wisdom gained by Pichon, Kim, Devine and Sleeze in Oxford, by Stuart et al. In Irvine. So here's my cartoon, one stream going into a disk, starting beyond 2 RVR at the cosmic web. It's the regime of linear tidal torques, where the stream gains an impact parameter. This is how it reflects the angular momentum. Okay? Then, in the outer halo, the angular momentum is just transported in a constant specific angular momentum. And then, most interesting regime in the inner halo, okay, which you may call the outer tilted ring. Here is where dissipation, nonlinear torques, exchange angular momentum, and this stuff spirals in into the inner disk. And then you get the inner disk, which due to instability and so on, and outflows, exchange angular momentum, ends up roughly with what we thought it would, just from dark matter alone, but going through a very different procedure of in which the cold matter has three times more angular momentum than the dark matter. Anyway, this leads, you can see it here, three different galaxies. You see the cold streams penetrate the VL radius pretty straight with a fixed impact parameter that carries the angular momentum. And then if you zoom in, you see this outer ring. It's not really fully covered. No, it's still pretty messy incoming streams, but it's rotating. It's dominated by rotation. And it's really an outer ring, pretty much schematically like a huge warp between 10 and 30 kiloparsec outside the inner disk. And you see the stream coming in. This is the streamlines in one snapshot. You see how the stream joined the disk like you join an expressway with a road. But the point that's relevant to us here, first, this is detectable. And Nicolas Boucher might tell you that he might have detected this, and others have seen things by absorption systems. But the point here for the feedback again is that all the way to the inner disk, there's still a lot of space in different directions perpendicular to the disk for the outflows to go out. Okay? This is just the streamlines of the same thing showing the outer disk and the inner disk. Again, the importance of the outer disk is it's observable as a test for all this picture. So this is how the stream joined the disk. Many people talked about how to put feedback in the simulations. This is our version. We do 60 art zooming cosmological simulations of massive galaxies at a maximum resolution of 25 parsecs. We have supernova feedback done, put in as energy during 40 million years with no delays, but we do have artificial runaway stars. Most interesting is radiation pressure, okay? Put in the adjacent cells as isotropic pressure if they're dense enough and it's done for 5 million years. It's giving you mass loading factors for the outflows between 0.2 and 10, average of 2 with this feedback recipe. And this is two typical galaxies. You see the gas density, the dilute region here to which the hot outflowing gas goes. You see the inflow in blue and the outflow in yellow and red. They keep pretty much keep away from each other. In this sense, they live in harmony. They don't hurt each other too much. There's a dense called metal pool inflows, which penetrate all the way to the disk. And there's hot, metal-rich, fast outflow that fly through the dilute medium. If you ask, what is the penetration of the inflow? The low metallicity stuff that goes all the way to the inner halo relative to what enters the outer halo. This is plotted as a function of mass loading factor or another measure of outflow strength. The first thing you notice is that this number is not much smaller than unity. That's the basis for my claim that penetration is not hurt beyond a factor of 2. Second, you notice that the penetration can be higher for stronger feedback. This is just a manifestation of the dual role of feedback. On one hand, it generates outflows. On the other hand, it suppresses star formation, which suppresses outflows. So it can go either way. In this case, the stronger feedback, okay, creates less outflows or less effect on the inflows. You can see it here. These are 30 simulations with supernova feedback only. These are the same galaxies, but now with radiative feedback, stronger feedback, and somewhat higher penetration, because the most of the effect of this was to suppress star formation, suppress the outflow, particularly in this regime. But it's not a big difference. Even this is around half penetration. Another very interesting feature is the very strong recycling that we have in outflows. If you look in the inner 0.1 RV, this is the outflow strength, and this is the recycled material, all the gas-rich material that goes in. And you see that most of the snapshots, each point is a snapshot of different galaxies, different times, show recycled accretion comparable to the outflow. Very strong recycling in the inside, not so much when you go to the real radius. I want to show you a BASTAM model that illustrates something very interesting here. Just continuity equation with the mass loading factor here and the fraction of mass left in stars here. Let's fix it. This includes the outflow and the recycling. So the accretion minus the star formation for gas and stars. For the accretion rate, we take a toy model expression that's pretty good at high redshift and allows an integration to this exponential growth. Star formation rate, I just model it with epsilon FF for the galactic dynamical time here. You know, that this equation has a simple quasi-state solution as long as A and T are constant, and we use this approximation even when they vary slowly. So you end up solving this and get analytic solution for the observable gas fraction, stellar to LO mass fraction, and specific star formation rate. It turns out that if you ignore any stellar accretion, assume it's all gas accretion, which may be okay at high redshift, this thing is only a function of the star formation efficiency. This thing is only a function of the mass loading factor. And this one is independent of both, okay? Which is a very nice feature of this simple model that allows you to learn something about this parameter, and this result, in particular, this factor could be bigger than unity. And you can get the very funny situation in which the specific star formation rate is higher than the specific accretion rate into the galaxy. So this is a numerical integration and the analytic solution as a function of time. You see the accretion rate, the specific star formation rate, the gas fraction, and you see how the stellar to VL mass ratio depends very strongly on the assumed outflow, and the others don't. You try to compare it to observations, and you see that you can get a very good fit at very high redshift. There are many different new observations. High specific star formation rate above the specific accretion rate, okay, by a factor of two or so. That's because of this mu factor. You see a good fit here with epsilon of around 0.02 for dynamical time, and you get a good factor here for a mass loading factor of about unity. However, there's a problem around redshift 2. And the problem is, no matter what you do, you cannot recover this very high specific star formation rate. One way to do it is by getting the mass loading factor to be zero, which means recycling comparable to the outflow. This is the maximum you can have, and you're still left with a factor of three discrepancy. Another way out is that there is an observational biases, because these are limited to star-forming galaxies, but the model is for all the galaxies. Half of them are supposed to be quench galaxies. So keep this in mind. There is a challenge at redshift 2, which we need to work on, and recycling is probably a very important part of the game that one needs to worry about, to get it right and to get it maximum to alleviate this discrepancy. But you see, this is a trivial bathtub toy model, but this result is very, very robust. And I bet you will see it in any simulation you'll try. Chapter 2. You have disk clamps and you have violent disk instability, redshift 2, redshift 3. Because the gas density is high, you end up with, and you have a very high accretion rate, the Tumbrian Q parameter gets less than unity, in particular because of a lot of cold stuff, a lot of gas in particular. This gives you giant clamps. The clamp mass and size grow up also because of the high gas density. This is, I call this violent instability, because mostly it's affecting the dynamics, because the clamps are so massive, they're dynamically effective. Everything happens on an orbital time scale. It's not a secular evolution at all. Actually, I now tend to believe that this is not Tumor instability. It's some nonlinear instability triggered by nonlinear trigger, but that's a different talk. So this is our high resolution simulation. You see those clamps, edge on and face on. This is how you see it, a little lower resolution movie. Stuff comes in to the outer ring and to the disk and builds a disk face on which immediately develops nonlinear violent disk instability. The clamps, one thing they do after they form, they migrate inwards, okay, within a couple of 300 million years. Now, what is the clamp evolution during migration? This has to do, of course, with the outflows from the clamps. So the same tunnel instability, notice this parameter, it's very useful. It's really sigma over V when Q is 1. And it's really defined as the coiled mass divided by the total mass within the disk radius. So migration to the center by torques and counters and so on is proportional to this parameter to the minus 2. And it's this order, about 8 dynamical times, crossing times. The mass gain you can estimate analytically using the tumor radius, and it's very similar to the migration time. The star formation rate, if you estimate it properly, it's around 3 times the migration times. And the momentum-driven outflow, this is the touchy point, of course. In this paper with Mark, we derive it, we convince ourselves it's a steady wind, and we modeled the force by radiation pressure to be proportional to the star formation rate with this parameter, which we estimated to be total of an order of a few, which gives you mass relief factor of 1 or 2. This is, of course, based, among other things, on the instability work that we heard of in the not very high tau regime. And I think the Davis result will be consistent with this in this regime for the giant clamps. And we added all other components. Here we showed it's consistent with the clamps observed by Tacconi, Genzel et al. The outflow or time will be 1 over the mass relief factor, the star formation time, or 1 or 2 dynamical time. So this is how the time scales relate to each other, telling us what's going to happen first during migration. And you see, all of these are comparable or slightly longer than the migration time. So now let's apply continuity equation for the clamp itself, for individual clamp. Okay? It's the accretion into the clamp from the disk, star formation rate, and outflow from the clamp in 2 limits. One where the stars only grow by star formation in the clamp, and the other by which there's maximum loss of stars from the clamps by tidal stripping. Define the depletion time in the usual way, and you can derive an analytic solution for the depletion time, and this is what it looks like. Okay, as a function of the mass loading factor that you assume for the outflows, this is the final mass of the clamp at the end of its migration, divided by its initial mass. If you follow this line, it's the total mass of the clamp, and you see it's close to unity at all times to within a factor of 2. No big changes to the giant clamp masses during migration. In particular, in this regime, realistic mass loading factors, the clamp mass is pretty much the same as the initial mass. It's pretty constant. In this regime, very low mass loading factor, the clamp mass doubles because of the accretion. If very strong outflows, the clamp mass can go to 0, the clamp can disappear. Also note that the gas fraction in this regime below eta of about 4 is pretty much a constant. The clamp keeps a constant gas fraction. This was confirmed in simulations. For it to be noted it in isolated galaxy simulation, we have done it in cosmological simulation. This is what we see for the mass fraction of clamps in many galaxies in a cosmological simulation. And what you see here as a function of clamp mass, all the clamps above 10 to the 8-ish solar masses survive. The blue is with no for negative feedback, the red is with stronger feedback. The clamps that are smaller than 10 to the 8 tend to be disrupted partly by the outflows. And you can see it here the same if you divide by the disk mass relative thing. The slope here is around minus 2. Mike Falls, minus 2. Not surprising. So, in a few pictures, this is supernova feedback alone. This is stronger supernova plus radio feedback. Just showing you a few examples of the gas and star formation. This is supposed to be H alpha picture. Okay? You see that the disk become a little bigger because of the stronger feedback. The big clamps survive. The small clamps, which you don't see here, disappear. Here you see smaller clamps that don't show up here, but you do see a few more massive clamps. In this case, there was a big effect. Most of the clamps disappeared, and they show up only in the region. But in this case, the small clamps disappeared, but quite a few very massive clamps start showing up in the outskirts, and in particular here. Very unstable ring. Actually, more feedback generated a larger radius, bigger clamps. So this is kind of a summary of what I just said about this clamp evolution. And what we learn from this is we expect a weak gradient of clamp mass in disk, not a very strong gradient, because the evolution is not very strong during migration, but you expect an age gradient. If you can measure age by accuracy of less than 200 or 300 million years, you will see an age gradient in the disk. And people, the Cornet alpha and have seen this. My last point is about compactification and quenching and the role of feedback in this. So let me start with observations. As a function of the central mass density in galaxies, you see specific star formation rate pointing down. Blue here, red here. High redshift going to low redshift. Many galaxies from candles. You start seeing what people know, that at redshift 2 or so, elliptical galaxies are very compact. Very high surface density in the inner part. At even higher redshift, you have as compact blue galaxies forming stars. So you can't escape the conclusion that these guys quench and become these guys. These are the blue nuggets, progenitors of the red nuggets. And how do you get blue nuggets? You can do it by compactification from the diffuse disk galaxies. So there's a suggestive evolution track. You start from these diffuse disk galaxies, you compactify in the center, and then you quench. So let's remind ourselves a little bit about the self-regulated Van Allen disk instability. There are torques between the perturbation that drive angular momentum out and then mass inwards, starting from Gami and before. Now, you can very easily estimate the inflow time rate to be proportional to this factor, delta to the minus 2, for example, by asking the energy gain of the inflow, which is this. This is the potential energy that you gain by inflowing through a potential well of V squared. And this is the turbulent energy that you need to balance or to supply all the time to keep itself regulated. And this immediately gives you this kind of inflow rate, or 25 or so solar mass per year at redshift 2. But it's not only the clamp inflow, it's mostly gas inflow triggered by this torques. Now, in the little paper I wrote with Andy Burkert recently, well, the trivial statement is that if you have a compact stellar spheroid, it must come from a dissipative process, namely a wet inflow into a blue nugget. That's the only way I know to make a compact system, more compact than what cosmology and speed parameter conservation gives you. This can be by measures or by VDI, violent disk instability. The inflow is wet into the center if the inflow is faster than the time scale for star formation. Otherwise, it will not be a wet inflow. You get stuck with stars in the disk. You use this key idea, you use Q equals 1, okay, and you get that the wettest parameter, which is the ratio of those two timescales, is bigger than unity for typical values of these parameters. That's coming here. So you do expect wet inflow, especially at high redshift, where the gas fraction is a half or so, or higher. Also, if your system is of low spin to begin with, in the log normal distribution of spins. And this will give you automatically a smaller gas radius, a higher wettness parameter, because it scales like delta squared, okay, which scales like this. And this will give you the compactification. These are the two main conditions for compactification. Evidence that the bulges in our simulations really have a wet origin come from this distribution of what is the fraction of bulge stars that are born in the bulge. And you see that about 50%, the blue, of the bulge stars form in situ in the bulge, indicating wet inflow. Much less come from the disk or come from mergers, which is the red. Again, they're driven by VDI or by wet mergers. So this is a simulation version of the observational plot. It's all inside the effective radius in this case. Okay, so you see here, this is one galaxy out of our 60 galaxies. This is the compactification. Okay? The compactification is wet because the inflow rate is faster than the star formation rate, as expected. In this galaxy in particular, there are no much mergers going on. There's one merger here where the mass, stellar mass grows. And this may trigger the quenching. And this is the quenching process. It turns out that the quenching starts when the inner system, the inner bulge, becomes self-gravitating, as opposed to being dominated by the dark matter halo. If you ask what drives it, it's partly efficient star formation rate and partly outflows. Stellar outflows. We don't have any AGN feedback. AGN feedback will boost this quenching. The same thing viewed in a different way as a function of redshift of time going from left to right. This is the mass within the inner 1 kiloparsec. This is a blue nugget forming. The gas and stars compactify more mass inside the inner 1 kiloparsec. Wet inflow, this line is the inflow rate, this one is the star formation rate, and indeed, it's wet. Inflow rate is faster during this period. No mergers here. This green tells you about merger. So there's merger only triggering this quenching. The gas fraction goes down, the star formation rate drastically goes down. This is the quenching. You see that the inflow and the star formation rate and the outflow becomes the same. The reason the inflow is similar to the outflow is the recycling. A lot of recycling in the inner 1 kiloparsec. The fact that the red line became above the black line tells you that you, at this point, become self-gravitating. The bulge becomes self-gravitating. I won't dwell on this too much, just to tell you that when you are dark matter dominated, for two good reasons, you can allow quenching. You can allow the gas fraction to go down. But for the sake of time, stop. Three other examples showing very similar behavior of compactification at quenching at different redshifts. So it can happen at any time, many times triggered by a merger. In pictures, time goes from here to here. In these galaxies, This is the gas and new stars during compactification. This is the blue nugget. This is after quenching started, you develop a disk around it, and you develop a quenched inner bulge, almost a horn of gas, and nice clumpy ring with star formation around it. This is the stellar distribution. This is the blue nugget phase. This is the red nugget phase. Another galaxy, many little mergers making this blue nugget, focusing on this bulge, very compact bulge from gas, little clumpy disk, and yet a quenched galaxy with a trace of a nice unstable ring. In this case, it's an unstable, very dilute gas at the end. Very little gas around this elliptical galaxy that formed here. So how do you go from blue to red? The blue nugget is a high star formation and outflows from a compact gaseous bulge. At this time, there's already a compact stellar system, and eventually it becomes a red nugget with a trace, a ring of gas around it. That's the red nugget. One other way to quench is by terminating the instability in the inside in various different ways. And let me show you that indeed the spin parameter of the disk, if it's low as it is here, you end up with a higher compactification as expected from the Metis argument. So the simulations do confirm what we saw from a very simple theoretical argument. So the summary of this point is that the two modes of evolution, if you have a high gas density disk, low spin parameter, you have a wet inflow by VDR merger, and you have a starburst, outflow burst here, and bulge quenching here, to several effects. Don't forget that there's halo quenching as well. If you have a slow process here with lower gas disk, you don't need the bulge necessarily. If the halo is big enough, gas supply is quenched by itself. I want to show you this before I go to the summary. In today's galaxies, this is the only low redshift stuff I'm showing you. Showing you the specific star formation rate, average, quenched galaxies red, star forming galaxies here. You notice that the lines of constant specific star formation rate are horizontal here. The gradient is here. So when you compactify, you also quench by those various mechanisms. But when you already compact, if the halos are above a critical mass of 10-12 solar mass, gas supply is quenched, and you quench even further. And you do need probably both quenching mechanisms to trigger the quenching and to maintain it for a long time. So let me conclude. The inflows do live in harmony with the outflows to within a factor of 2. The streams join the disk through an outer tilted rotating disk, which is observable, a little tilted, can extend to 30 or 40 kilopascals. There is strong recycling, and there is a challenge to any theory of simulation how to get a specific star formation rate of 2 or 3 per giga year at redshift 2. Recycling is one key, but maybe not enough. With the trapping in radiative feedback of mass loading of a few, giant lumps do survive the feedback. They keep roughly a constant mass to migration, the small clumps to disrupt. There's a typical mode of evolution for ISD galaxies, which I think we understand theoretically and see very clearly in our simulations. There's wet compactification, either by mattress or by VDI or by both. You get compact star-forming galaxies. You can call them blue nuggets. This high star formation rate and the outflows, as long as you are already self-navigating, creating very efficient quenching. And you get compact red nuggets, sometimes or initially with outer star-forming rings around them. And always didn't for long-term quenching. Thanks.
So how do the various quenching mechanisms synchronize? So the halo quenching has to immediately follow the other quenching process so that the galaxy stay quenched. How do they know when to do that?
I don't know for sure, but I think that you can have it either way. So in some cases we see the bulk quenching working first, okay? But then you have to keep it red for a long time. So then the halo quenching kicks in. So bulk quenching can occur even if the halo is small and there's not much hot stuff. But then when you start quenching, if you want to keep the galaxy quenched, you need the halo to be big. In some cases, if the halo is still small, you can have the galaxy quenched and come in blue again and then quench again. This does happen. But if the halo had enough time to grow, be big, and sustain a very shock with enough hot gas, this will not happen. Once you quenched, you will be left quenched. Can you have halo quenching without bulk quenching? I'm not sure. I think that halo quenching is a slower process because it only quenches the supply of gas, but you have to totally consume the gas that's already there or get rid of it. So I have a feeling that you need some kind of bulk quenching always. Or when I say bulk quenching, AGN quenching is coming in there too. By the way, AGN quenching may also couple to the halo quenching because the hot gas is a better victim for coupling with the AGN, as you know.
So the high redshift here is about redshift 2 or 3.
Sorry?
High redshift is redshift of 2 or 3-ish here?
High redshift 7.
Okay.
But so redshift 2 to 4 is the most active phase of galaxy formation. Everything happens.
There might be something similar at lower redshift. So Ned Taylor has looked at the gamma survey and looked in particular at bulges, looking at for that population of galaxies, bulges and colors and star formation rates. And in particular, seeing the how you get from one population to the other, and his summary of those, in his words, is first you get fat, and then you get old, and then you die. So first you form the bulge, and then most of your stellar population goes red, and then star formation stops. So that seems consistent with this sort of wet compactification.
Who are you quoting?
Ned Taylor, as part of the Gamma Survey.
Okay.
Could this sort of thing work at low redshift, I guess, is the question.
No. In fact, it's very surprising. There are works done all the way to redshift 0. There are papers by my friends in Santa Cruz and me, that Cheung et al., Feng et al., the same story is seen from redshift 0 to redshift 4 or 5. At high redshift, it's mostly the fast quenching with the bulge. At low redshift, halo quenching takes over. Everything is slower. I absolutely agree with this.
So Amish, I have two questions related to observing these streams. So you're talking about the streams meeting the disk in this warped disk. And what about the recycled material? I'm wondering about the metallicity, right? And whether within some radius, we won't see, you wouldn't expect to see truly primordial gas anymore.
Yeah. What I showed you here are recycling inside 0.1 RV, which in this case is about 10 kiloparsec at redshift 2. The tilted ring extends in some cases to 30 or 40 kiloparsec. So there's a hope that in the outer part of this, you already have a rotation signal, okay, say at half the field radius, without too much recycling. But we can work together and try to fine-tune the predictions for this. What is the optimal radius to look for an absorption system that will be less contaminated by outflowing material, and to what degree is it is? Also, the outflowing material will have a different kinematics, I assume. I'm not sure that it will join the other ring. Okay? It probably will go also in different directions. So it will be different kinematics.
So then I also wondered...
What I need from you is many line of sights in one galaxy. Mm-hmm. Can you give me this?
We will try. We may need a 30-meter telescope, though. So as these streams are meeting this warp disk, do you expect signs of shocked gas, or is it the fall somehow softens
that it
doesn't shock?
That's a very good question. So what you saw here is only a picture, and I know about the kinematics. We are now studying from scratch all the instabilities that go as a stream goes down. So we start with a very simple problem of a very simple stream, supersonic stream going inside a hot medium. We see Kelvin-Hellman instability, we see shocks forming, and what happens? Then we put in gravity, we put in these cosmological conditions, and we will try to learn what really happens dynamically in those systems. So far, it's only pictures and signal of rotation that I can tell you about, and this nice warp shape. But it's an excellent question.